The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
We got a big January rally. Trade talks seemingly soothe markets. Banks are surging, and our guest today is Brian Curzio. He's just been to CES. We're going to talk about technology and the economy and markets and so much more. All this and much more on episode number 596 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello and welcome. This is Andrew Horowitz, and you're listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast, where we come together and share ideas, thoughts, some educational material, and everything in between about finance. We bring on some great guests, and we have one today that I think is going to be just a great conversation, because every time Frank comes on, we do have a wonderful time talking about all things related to markets and some of the names that you should be watching these days, some of the technology advancements, etc. And of course, he's been just to CES, so we're going to talk about that. Hopefully, you had the opportunity to listen to last week's episode, where we talked about hedging opportunities. Now, with the markets, of course, moving up on all sorts of news related to earnings, as well as some of the Fed speak, and of course, the seemingly better news about the China and U.S. trade war, maybe it's time to listen to that and consider what's going on. If you have any concerns about the levels of the market, maybe being overbought, maybe being a little bit ahead of itself, just something to consider. Anyway, I want to spend a lot of time with Frank, so let's get right to that discussion. And here he is, the one, the only, Frank Curzio from Curzio Research. He's a regular guest, of course, because he has just an incredible amount of information to share and wisdom to impart on us. So, Frank, I know, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing good, man. It's been busy. I just came back from the Consumer Electronics Show, and then I'm leaving to go to Vancouver to speak at a mining conference, the VRIC, the Vancouver Resource Investment Conference. So, yeah, as you know, January is a crazy month. It's most conferences. You got earnings season now, and a lot going on. And you know, it's hard to focus. And you know, I try to tell the people in my podcast, individual investors, that, you know, you're coming off the holidays, but man, you can find some really great ideas in January. You got the JP Morgan Healthcare Conference that just happened as well. I mean, some very, very big events, and they all happen in January, unfortunately.
I don't know why they do it in January, because January is so, there's so much to do in January in terms of, you know, end of year, beginning of year, and paperwork and reporting and just tax issues and all that. It seems like some of these are, you know, some of these maybe it's a distraction because nobody wants to deal with that other stuff. I don't know. But anyway, let's talk a little bit about what's going on with regard to, we'll get to CES because I have some things. By the way, I did follow you on Twitter and all your various videos and your ping-ponging, and we'll talk about that. That was some cool stuff there, the ice hockey. But let's talk a little bit about, I thought we'd start with the economy, earnings. Earnings season just started. We saw the banks, of course, kick it all off. And we saw some initial numbers that looked soft in terms of when we saw the Citigroup numbers come out and Wells Fargo come out, and then Goldman Sachs came out and just blew it out. And then bank after bank, it seems that all of a sudden there's a new, renewed love for the banks. So while there was a lot of concern about, hey, you know what, with the tightening yield curve and some concerns about the geopolitical issues and geoeconomic issues that banks would have a problem, it seems to me what happened, and tell me what you think, that there was a really, really low bar set for these banks in terms of earnings, and many of them just vaulted right over.
Yeah, I mean, you're looking at the banks, right? I mean, interest rates were a big deal. I think everyone saw interest rates going higher, but you know, look, you and I and everybody else could predict where interest rates are going, if it's going to be one hike, two hike, but I could tell you, they're definitely going to stop raising rates in 2019. I mean, the inflation numbers have come down dramatically. And listen, we know that inflation numbers for us and food and things like that and tuition are higher. But what the government looks at and what the Fed looks at is the CPI and also the PPI. And those numbers are coming down, not showing any inflation. So when you know, the interest rate environment, one of the risks when we saw interest rates really pop higher, I think was a big risk for banks. And you're right. If you look at you know, Citigroup's numbers were okay. They weren't great, but the stock fell from, where was it, 74, 75 to like 50. It went under 50.
Right.
You're looking at 30% declines in some of these names, and I'm a big fan of Citigroup only because they're returning $60 billion to investors. And that's what you have to realize with the banks. And put your personal feelings aside, because I know nobody likes the banks and everybody got bailed out. You know, our job is to provide good investment opportunities. When I look at Citigroup, as I think it should be a staple in a lot of portfolios. Where, I mean, $60 billion in capital is 15-17% of the market cap. And same with the rest of the banks. I mean, these banks weren't allowed to buy back stock in 2010, 11, 12, 13. And the government finally said, okay, the stress test, if you pass them and these ratios are good, and I won't get too complicated, but now they could buy back stock, they could raise their dividends, and they're sitting on a massive, you know, just cash piles that they're not allowed to lend out, they're not allowed to do anything with. So now they return it back to investors, where it's almost guaranteed that Citigroup's earnings are going to go higher with the amount of shares that they're going to continue to buy back. And we're also looking at Citigroup trading well below book value still. I mean, this stock that was at 49, and it's up at 61, 62 now, you know, trading below 10 times forward earnings. You know, when I look at some of these banks and Goldman Sachs, I mean, Andrew, that company got smoked.
Well, that was the 1MDB thing. There was a lot of controversy after Blank Fund left and, you know, all that. But one of the things about Citi is if you look at Citi and you compare it to the other, you know, big banks or the banking center types of banks, it is probably, well, maybe a little bit different after the recent run-up, but one of the cheapest on almost every metric. So that's good.
Yes, it's good. And it's, listen, if a stock is cheaper on every metric, right, sometimes that could be bad. I mean, Netflix, we can talk about Netflix too. I mean, that stock, you know, is crazy expensive. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, we could break that down. But if you look at 2004, it's trading 115 times earnings. 2005, 80 times, 90 times earnings. And the stock's up thousands of percent because you're seeing that growth. So sometimes cheaper is not always great. But when I look at the buybacks in place and when I see you're getting a nice dividend and it is trading at a 15, 20% discount to the rest of the industry, every other major bank, the other three, JP Morgan, Wells, and Goldman.
Bank of America.
Bank of America. So, you know, their competitors, they're all trading well over book value. So, you know, for me, it's not just buying it on valuation, which is great, but that, I mean, they're buying back more stock as a percentage of their float than anyone, and they're going to continue to raise a dividend. They have the cash to do it. And that's something I like. I just, listen, you get it in a market where you're seeing crazy moves, especially towards the end of the year. Yep. I think Citigroup's a pretty good holding that should do well, especially with those buybacks over the next 2 years.
So you brought it up. You brought up Netflix. Let's talk about that for a second. That's a core holding for actually, we've held that for a while now. And it's interesting because we usually are looking at, for our particular portfolio, the managed growth strategy, we look at things like earnings growth, and we look at ROE, and we look at revenue growth, and we look at historically to make sure they get over these hurdles, and that's the only way you get included in our portfolio. Well, Netflix has been there for a while because they continually grow, as you mentioned. I thought, though, on a separate note, it was really interesting that they came out with their price hike a few days before their earnings release. And I said, wow, that's great. As a matter of fact, about a week before that, somebody said to me, should I buy Netflix? I said, you know, the thing about Netflix that you need to know is all they have to do, this is what I said to them about a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, all they have to do is increase their subscription cost by a dollar. Nobody will flinch. Nobody's going to stop because of an extra dollar. And they get an extra $50 million per month in just like that. Lo and behold, it does happen a week later. But I looked at it with a strange eye when I saw that just a couple of days before they raised it, and really made me have some question about what was going to be the earnings. And again, the earnings did come in while they had better subscription growth rate. And there was a variety of things that were good. They still have about a $3 billion burn rate on cash. And on top of that, their earnings expectation, their guidance was like, I don't know, cut in half almost.
Yeah, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. I mentioned that actually on my Friday podcast, Frankly Speaking, where I had to, you know, just take questions from people and answer them, you know, really quick. So, and I said the same thing. I said, when you come down to analyzing stocks, you know, anybody could read a balance sheet, you could learn it, could take it 2 years, could take it 10 years, 20 years, but you also have to use everything else and common sense. And for me, I was amazed and that 3 days earlier than the quarter, why would you? You would only announce that if the numbers aren't going to be.
Yeah, it has to be.
Why not wait till the quarter, right? So everyone went crazy, saw it on Kramer, saw it everywhere. And listen, they have the best content. People are going to pay. No one's going to cancel their subscription. It's awesome. But at the end of the day, and I've been a huge fan of Netflix for a long time. I mean, you know, I wasn't like 5-6 years ago, the valuation. And I realized, listen, it's not that Netflix is competing with the cable companies. All the entire market of cable companies is competing with Netflix.
Right.
And then I started to get it. And I understood why I had the premium valuation. But that valuation is okay as long as they're growing earnings. They cut earnings by almost in half.
I know.
Now,
well, for next quarter, though. For next quarter. Not for...
Right. Yeah, for next quarter. For next quarter. And they're going to burn through $3 billion, which is going to be even more. And if you look at the subscribers, because this is a company that trades on subscription growth, and that has to stop for this company, because what they're doing is they're going all in internationally. And those clients and those subscribers are not subscribers of domestic, like ours in domestic, and plus in other developed areas. So they're adding subscribers in places where they don't have as much content. Yes, you could, you know, just... you can watch a lot of the stuff where you can capture this, whatever, but they're not the quality subscribers. And people are saying, wow, they keep adding subscribers, they keep adding subscribers, but the cost is unbelievable. I mean, $3 billion in cash flow, negative cash. Again, they said another $3 billion this year. If you look at their content, right, it's amazing, but they're getting high-profile actors. I mean, what was the Bird Box with Sandra Bullock. Sandra Bullock is, what, $10, $15 million to hire her? I mean, you have Adam Sandler, whether you like him, that very high-profile. Generates a lot of money with his movies. You also have Chris Rock now. You see, like, they are paying prime prices. Now, what does that mean? Well, you know, if you add a lot of subscribers, it's cool. But if I tell you, well, it's costing me $150 per subscriber, it's not so cool. And that's kind of what you saw at this quarter. And what amazed me is I'm not even saying a few, every analyst that I looked at this morning or last week, every analyst that I looked at after they reported, they raised their estimates.
Well,
they raised sales earnings and the target price. And I'm looking at it going expectations. And that's a big deal. Same thing happened to Apple. Every 100 of 140 plus analysts that cover the stock had buy ratings, not one sell rating, even though that stock fell 35% from its highs and got crushed. If you're looking at Netflix right now, when I see the earnings, now you have to look at valuation because they're not growing earnings as fast. And maybe it's just a quarter, I don't know, but it was just scary enough where the stock's up 50% since Christmas, less than a month. Expectations, they're going to be even higher. And not to just beat this to death, this is important. So I just did a little analysis on this. This year, they expected to generate $2.64.
Okay.
So 2018, based on that number, they're trading at 130 times forward earnings. Guys, the S&P trades at 16, 17 times forward earnings. Next year, projected to generate $4.54. So that's, what, 80% growth,
mm-hmm.
right? If we take that number, forward earnings are trading at 80 times. But 2020 amazes me because this is the analyst estimates. This is what the stock trades on, the consensus. They're expecting earnings to like go to $8 a share.
How is that even possible?
$2.64. But even if they're right in 2020 and you take that number for 2020, it's still trading at 50 times forward earnings.
Which is, by the way, that wouldn't be terrible for a big growth company if you're going to be doubling your earnings. But I don't, you know, this reminds me of the days with Dell. When Dell, everybody kept on upgrading continually and the stock kept on going. If you remember how Dell went straight up for a long period of time, it was the best stock ever, forever.
Absolutely.
Until there was a realization that you can't have this many desktops being sold, because if you did actually extrapolate the growth plan by the analysts, not by Dell, by the analysts, everybody would have like 3 or 4 desktops sitting on every desk they owned. And it's a scientific impossibility.
Yeah, and listen, we saw the same thing with Amazon and what happened. They got into cloud, and then they got into Alexa. We can talk about that later. Like, they just, if you're looking at the current business model, it's not going to support the valuation because they're spending more money than ever. And again, valuation, if you're looking at something trade 80, 50, 100 times forward earnings, much more expensive than the market, it's not a reason to sell it. You just have to make sure that that premium is justified. And the fact that they basically cut next quarter's earnings in half and lowered revenue numbers as well, I just can't believe not one person blinked. Like, everyone's like, oh, it's fine. They're going through the roof. And and it's just scary for me right now. Netflix.
And the stock was only down about 3.5% on the print.
Yeah. And I'm talking about now. I'm not talking about before. Like, just, I it's so funny you said that. And I just said the same thing. I'm like, why is this company, and I actually tweeted that, why is this company announcing a price hike like 3-4 days before the quarter? Why don't I wait till the quarter? And it's because those numbers are going to be terrible.
And the lesson here is, by the way, that sometimes you have to read the tea leaves. You have to understand that while the news was good because it is beneficial, there was something else brewing that the company decided to do. So sometimes you see pre-announcements from companies. What they try to do is they come in and lowball their number so that they can come back. They know, hey, listen, we did project that we're going to do 50 cents in this quarter, whatever, but we're really seeing like more like 42. And then miraculously, the stock comes down pretty hard. And then when they report, they come out with 46. You know, this we've seen this time and time again. It's a process and game that's being played by companies all the time. We know it. We've seen it. We just got to pay attention to it.
Exactly. And I mean, look, I'm looking at it today with a stock that's gone up 50%. Yes, the price hike is awesome. Yes, they have great content. Yes, I'm a big fan. But at this valuation, the fact that they lower their numbers that much, and again, it could be just one quarter, but I'd be very careful buying it and even wait. Even if you missed a 5%, 7%, 8%, whatever it is over the next 3 months and next quarter, because they warn, again, watch out. That thing's going to fall 20, 25% from its highs. Hopefully, it's just like a one-quarter thing. But it's clear that they're spending a lot more money in order to generate more subscribers, more than they ever have in the company's history.
So let's go a little bit more broad-based for a moment here. Let's talk about some of the economics that we've been seeing. We saw that China's economy was recently revised lower in terms of 2018. Their outlook has been coming down in terms of GDP. We see their manufacturing numbers suffer. We've seen that in Europe, the PMIs, are when you look at the blended global PMIs, the worst in about 6 months. What is going on in terms of your outlook? Because we are also seeing that consumer confidence in the U.S. has come down a bit. We're seeing that manufacturing is slowing. The ISM numbers looked a little bit weaker. Services were a little bit in line. But generally speaking, we're seeing a little bit of a slowdown. And some of this could be due to the fact that there is a thrashing in the last 3 months of the year, which does cause confidence to wane a bit. But is this something that we should be concerned about? Because the markets all of a sudden don't seem concerned about this anymore.
You know what? I don't think so. I really liked the pullback. I didn't like the way how fast it pulled back, and I think it just overshot by a mile. But that's a normal course of the market, which we're not used to, right? Outside of maybe Brexit and a couple other things, if you look at the last 6-7 years, basically since the credit crisis, we haven't it's normal for every, I think it's 3.5-4 years for the market to pull back. I mean, you just see a correction, which is 10% off its highs, and this was more of, I think we hit 20% on all indices really quick before the bounce back. But it's a slowing environment, which, you know, we were growing earnings tremendously. A lot had to do with tax reforms from Trump, and you get it. And we're going to see a slowdown, but a slowdown is a lot different from a recession.
Yeah.
So when you're looking at the numbers and we're trading at, you know, one of the cheapest levels in the last 5 years, if you're looking at you know, on a whole at 16 times forward earnings, I mean, we got down to 14 times forward earnings. You're seeing earnings come down a little bit, but I think there's a lot of great opportunities out there. You just have to be smart. And you saw companies really overshoot, companies like Citigroup. I mean, 49 at 62. You look at Netflix, up 50% from its lows. I mean, some of these things got smoked. I'm seeing that in small caps as well. But overall, when I look at the economy, I see a slowing economy. I think everybody should expect it. I'm looking at interest rates going forward. They're going to stop raising in 2019. I don't know if it could be zero hikes, one more or two more. But in 2019, they're going to stop. The inflation numbers, you know, are telling us that. So we're looking at you know, progress with China and you know, the U.S., which was, you know, a big drag, especially to China since February. Holy cow. I mean, they have no choice. They have to do something because, I mean, they're looking at depression numbers now. I mean, I don't know. You watch the numbers. I don't know if
individual. Yeah, the numbers are pretty ugly. Cow. I mean, yeah, no, the numbers in China have definitely gone into contraction mode. They haven't seen a recession in I don't even know how long, ever. You know, it's like for a very long time. But the thing is that with all of this, you still have to wonder how much of the combination of higher rates, in other words, where we are now, the continuation of quantitative easing, and additionally the trade war as well as the government shutdown, how much is that going to affect GDP moving forward? And I think that technically, while we may not see a recession in the form of what we've seen in the past, whereas you get this general slowdown, an economic slowdown happens and you slowly get into it and all of a sudden you find out you're in a recession a couple of months later. I think there's going to be like a technical recession, if there's such a thing as that, where because of the government shutdown and the quantitative easing, the markets coming in as they did, consumer confidence waning, there is a high probability that we're going to see a zero, possibly even a negative print a lot sooner than we thought, at least for one quarter. Now that will resolve as soon as the government opens back up, as soon as we see that the trade war resolves in some way or another, and consumers and you know, get their confidence back a bit. But right now, it just looks like we're on a track to slowing, even though the general economy is very sound. Does that make any sense?
No, it does. And we have to be careful. I mean, because when we say the word recession, it's a big word. It's holy cow. But in the end, if we show growth and say we don't have that quarter print that you're predicting, and we show 0.1% growth and then 0.1% growth, quarterly growth for GDP the following quarter, that's not a recession. But if we show, you know, 0.1% negative two quarters, it's a recession. But when you put that name out, recession, oh my God, you know, people panic. And a lot has to do with sentiment, which we saw at the end of December. I mean, people were just running to the exits. I mean, some of these, I couldn't believe how far the market came down during
that was ridiculous.
That Christmas week, I was like, whoa, it was like 600, 700. I was like, holy cow, you know? So, we are seeing a slowdown. I think so. That's why when I look at companies like Netflix, where every single analyst is bullish, they're all raising their estimates. That means expectations are really high. I'd stay away from stocks like that because we are going to see a slowdown. The companies listen to conference calls, guys. Listen to the biggest companies. It's for free. It puts you on the same level field playing field as you know, the institutions where you can listen to them directly through their websites and listen to what they're saying. Listen to JP Morgan, those banks. Go back and listen, see what they're saying about the economy, different geographic infrastructure companies. You know, just you want to get a good picture of what they're saying because you know they're going to be talking their book, but they're going to tell you whether, hey, we're worried or not, or we're going to spend. And when you have uncertainty on tariffs, then you're going to pull back on spending. You have uncertainty on interest rates, which we had, where they're going to pull back on spending. So you know, that's one of the things, and that's one of the gauges I would look at. But right now we are slowing. I think some companies are undervalued, some are overvalued. And you know, it's a good opportunity. I say this sometimes, but I just feel like it's a stock picker's market.
But what's also interesting is one of the things, I'll tell you the one thing about what you just said that troubles me, not necessarily about what you said, but an offshoot of that. And that is that in a lot of conference calls, and more so than we've seen before, companies are nixing their forward guidance. And one of the problems with that is not all companies, but there's a lot of companies and a lot more companies that have said, you know what, we're not going to issue forward guidance. We saw some home builders do that. And that's in a time, you only see that in a time where there's a hazy forward look. They don't really know, well, it could be for a few reasons, right? One is they don't want to give it because they know it's bad, right? That's the first thing. Just like when Apple decided, hey, you know what? We're not going to be given iPhone numbers anymore. Everybody's like, huh? Why? Well, because they suck. They're not what they're supposed to be, right? But when companies come out and they say that, you know what? We don't have the visibility or the clarity of the outlook and we are no longer going to be providing guidance, that's always a red flag to me.
I agree. I mean, Apple was great. I mean, you know, Tim Cook coming out saying we're not going to report iPhone sales is like a pizzeria saying they're not going to tell you how many pizzas they sell. I mean, it was crazy. But I definitely, you know, I agree with that. You know, if they're not going to provide guidance, it's usually, you know, a lot of uncertainty with the company. I think that is a red flag. And if you're hearing that with companies where they're saying, listen, we're not going to report guidance, you're going to see the company get nailed. And you should, you know, stay away, wait for the next quarter and see what happens.
Let's start getting into the discussion then of, I wanted to mention one thing. You know, we talk about analysts. You talk about 100 analysts, 50 analysts, 30 analysts. Think about that for a second. Put this in perspective. The analyst community, let's say that there's 30 analysts, which is not a small amount of analysts that are rating a stock. 30 is a pretty good number, right?
Yep.
That's 30 people and with their teams underneath them, but 30 people that are basically the ones creating estimates on, you know, for stocks across the board or this one stock. Analysts are not the end all be all. And remember something, they have sometimes a little bit of an angle or an axe to grind or, you know, an ulterior motive involved here. So analyst information is good. Oftentimes you'll find that the same ones are bullish on everything. You know, I saw recently somebody come on CNBC says, you know, like we said back in March, we were a little concerned about the markets and blah, 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 this and that and this and that. But you know what? At the same time, when they talked about that in March, they didn't say, hey, we're taking money off the table. We're pulling back. No, we believe the long-term thesis is intact, et cetera. We're a little bit worried right now. It doesn't give you any incremental benefit when you start watching these analysts on TV because they're not usually going to come. There's only a handful that will come out and say anything negative about anything because, first of all, they're oftentimes talking their book. And second of all, they won't be invited back. We know that's the game, right?
Yeah, and guys, just to let you know how the game is played, these are businesses that make investment banking fees. There's a reason why no one had to sell on Apple, because if Apple's going to look to raise money, which they do, yes, we know they have, you know, whatever, $200 billion in cash, but yeah, with interest rates low still, you know, they can raise money whenever they want, just like Microsoft does. Yeah, they're not going to go to the people who have the sell rating on it. They're going to go to the people who have the buy rating on it, right? I mean, even if it's your company, you know, so but what's important with the analyst estimates is you need to understand it and you need to pay attention, because that's the sentiment. That's why I'm talking about Netflix, where all the analysts are bullish. That means there's very super high expectations, because the stock has run up 50% in a month and every analyst is even more bullish than ever. So when you want to look at, and Andrew and I have, you know, pay a lot of money for services that give us this information. I think you can find a Yahoo Finance, a couple of free sites, but it's important to understand where they are, because when you see on CNBC, you know, IBM reports and, you know, they beat estimates, whatever they report, you know, $5, whatever it is, but they beat estimates. They're beating the consensus estimates, and that's what's going to drive the stock higher or lower. So if you have a negative view on it, for me, when I looked at Apple, I just didn't see them making the estimates. And then Tim Cook just confirmed that Taiwan Semi converted 6 months ago. That's the best leading indicator of smartphones, that they make the chips for almost all these companies. And they were saying 6 months ago that it is a dramatic slowdown in smartphones, and Apple wasn't saying anything, and they were dead on. So, you know, try to pay attention to those estimates, because if Apple's estimates were really low and expectations were low, then you could say, okay, a lot of this is baked in. But that's why with Netflix, a lot of it's not baked in, because they just reported a bad earnings or a bit, you know, weak guidance. But when I look, you know, it's pretty scary when the stock's gone up 50% and every analyst is raising their estimates even more, right, and all it, you know, so that's why it's important.
So what you're saying is that sometimes there's a contrarian indicator, very similar to,
absolutely,
very similar to when you see that there's a high short interest. I think a lot of very new investors look at short interest on a stock and they say, wait a minute, that company has 50% short interest, or, you know, 65 days to cover. And they see, this is a really big short interest in a company, and man, I'm going to short it because a lot of people agree with me. I think it's a bad company too. The problem with that is that if anything incrementally positive comes out of the company's reports, news, anything, shorts will start to cover and it will be a magnificent move higher, because they need to all of a sudden get out of these positions. And when you have such a high level of that and they do come out with something incrementally positive, it is oftentimes a very good thing. That's where you hear the word short squeeze. Now, what's interesting about this is that, again, you have to look at this, because sometimes the short interest is such that it's a reasonable level. But if you see short interest really climbing dramatically on a stock, and especially before earnings, even if the news is bad, shorts may say, you know what, the stock came down, it hit my price, I'm going to buy. They may start a rally right there. So there's a lot of these little things that you need to look at in the market as contrarian indicators.
Yes, and that's important to look at. I mean, sentiment is a very, very big deal. When everyone's optimistic or leaning towards one side and a company misses, that thing's going to fall 10, 15, 20%. And the opposite as well. I mean, Citigroup estimates, they didn't blow out the estimates, but the stock fell to 49 and everybody was just like, the banks are dead. Same with Goldman Sachs. And look at the huge pop. And the reason why you saw such a big pop is because everybody was leaning to the opposite side, saying the banks, the interest rates. I mean, you know, when a stock falls, like Citi falls from 70 something to, you know, 49 in 3 months, you know, expectations are really low. So if you report in line, you just have to see your company or those numbers go from bad to less bad. And that's going to move the stock tremendously higher.
Yeah. And that's the lesson. When things are either baked in or they're overdone to either side. So, you know, when they get over that hurdle that is, you know, somewhat better than was expected in any way, I mean, that's where things really can play out very nicely. But let's get into this discussion for a second about some specific areas that I wanted to get to regarding CES. First of all, give us a taste of what it's like going to CES and what's involved, who goes, what's there, just a broad-based overview.
Yeah, it's the biggest conference in the world. So it's in Vegas every year. It's over 50 years old. And every single technology company, just about every single one, is going to, this is the place where they show off all the gadgets and devices they're going to launch in 2019 for the rest of the year. So it's held in Las Vegas in every January, and it's expanded to now, it used to be 2,000, 3,000. I mean, there's 4,500 companies. So for me, I've been going for, I think it's 7 straight years. I know the areas to go to. I know what I'm looking for ideas. But just going to this and you're seeing the new technologies, it's kind of great. There hasn't been innovation in the past 2 years, right? This is just basically accelerating things like AI, 5G. I mean, you know, the Consumer Electronics Show is known for launching like innovative products, its first VCR, or if it's, you know, the iPhone was launched there, you know, just the amazing products and first computer and stuff. There hasn't really been anything innovative. It's more like, hey,
it's more like upgrades. It's more like
it's upgrades. Yeah. It's new technologies. Right. It's smart homes and self-driving cars and stuff like that. So, but it's fascinating because, I mean, I have it on Twitter. I was playing against a ping pong robot. That's fantastic. I mean, he was kicking my butt actually. And then, you know, it was cool. So it has AI capabilities and they don't sell it. It's just showing how they use sensors, AI, and big data analytics. And it's basically teaching me how to become a better player and knows what level I'm on to step it up. So it could play pro and kill me, or it can go to my level and, you know, dressly and see it, my backhand's bad. And it's learning from you. So that was a big theme where AI is, you know, it's been a big theme for a while, but you're seeing it implemented now. If you have a Google Gmail account, if you type in a half a sentence, it fills in your sentence.
Oh, yeah, that's AI. It's pretty good, by the way. Wait, I want to back up though, because I saw you play the ping pong. You didn't look very good. I just want to say that.
I had a couple of points there.
But here's my question. Here's my question about it. Was that particular booth and what they were showing off, because it's not like you want to just, hey, I'm going to get a ping pong buddy robot. That's not the point. The point was the AI behind it. What company was that?
It depends who you're going with. There's a company called Omron. So it was an international company. But if you're looking, you know, if you're just going there as, you know, hey, I want to have fun. It's cool. There's a million things to try out. For me, and Andrew, I'll tell you this, why you should go there is because they give me a media badge because of the podcast. And I'm fortunate and humbled that, you know, we have a big enough audience and, you know, you provide the numbers for them. So these guys want to market their products. And when I go there, you know, you could basically, hey, you know, they'll cut the line. They know you're going to write about these companies and talk about them and tweet to your audience. So it time's a big factor there, right? It's a 5-day conference. And for me, that's important than waiting 3 hours to sample some of this technology. But it depends. I'm there to find new ideas for my investors. You can go there and say, hey, you know, I just want to see sample new technologies. I want to see the new sports technologies, which are amazing. So either way, you're going to have fun. But for me, looking at his investments, I want to see the advancements in AI, 5G. 5G is finally here. It's going to be here this year. I mean, everybody's been talking about it for 2-3 years. It's, you know, you need cell phone towers to be built, which were finally built. You got the wireless carriers, AT&T's, Verizon's finally, you know, the wireless, that's where they cover in the spectrum. They build the technology. Then you have the chip makers. Now the chip makers are going to say, okay, now we're going to make parts of phone 5G, the Skyworks, the Vago, whatever. And then you have the Apples and the Samsungs with their next generation of phones this year are going to incorporate 5G. So the trend is here. What does that mean? I don't know if it means too much to the individual investor, but for businesses around the world, I mean, you're going to see speeds 1,000 times greater. And think about that when it comes to algorithms, when it comes to the market, when it comes to, you know, all these firms tracking you, whether you like it or not, if it's social media, if it's Walmart, your spending patterns, they're going to be able to analyze data even quicker, which is scary because even though we all want to say we're spontaneous, we all do the same things every day, right? We're very, very predictable. I mean, we wake up the same time, drink coffee the same time, go to bed at the same time, we work the same hours, take our kids the same place. And they're just analyzing these patterns, which is gold to anyone that advertises, right? I mean, if you know what the people are going to buy and when they're going to buy it, when they're going on vacation, it's easy to advertise and you get, you know, more money in your ad spend.
All about the advertising. But here's an idea I have. Let me know what you think. Ready? Next year, January. Live from CES, it's Curzio and Horowitz podcast.
I'm in. Hey, listen, like we could get our own booth. Yeah. They asked me to get, I broadcasted before. There's everyone's there, CNN. You look at CNET, everybody. It's just, you know, CNBC has boots there. There's just everywhere. There's people interviewing everywhere. So for me, I just provided it. You know, I have Frank Curzio's with Twitter. You know, I was just providing live video feeds and sampling technology. And we got a lot of good feedback because it's fun. You get new ideas. And also you get, you know, some things that you won't invest in, which is interesting as well. Because I saw a couple of things that you know, that I wasn't impressed with.
The stupid factor. The things that are really cool but, like, have no application in real life kind of stuff.
Yeah, I'm talking about even trends, like wearables. I mean, it's a low barrier entry. I don't know if they think, like, we're going to all of a sudden grow, like, 15 arms, but we only have one of these things. There's, like, 1,000 companies there with wearables, and they all have the same features. Heartbeat, yes, you can answer your phone with it, and it, you know, tracks your steps and things like that. So, also, self-driving cars, like, you know, autonomous, fully autonomous vehicles, which is called Level 5. I mean, the investments that you're seeing, the OEM, the autos, the major automakers, Ford, you know, GM, Hyundai, whatever, Audi, make into this market is I just don't see it coming around anytime soon. Where we have fully autonomous, and you know, I like driving my car and going to the store really quick. Where I just can't see it, and they're going all in because they really don't have anything else other than, you know, maybe electric vehicles.
Well, but you got like an that. Aston Martin. I mean, that yeah, that's not fair to say for the rest of us. You know what I mean? That we're driving you know, some old Toyota. I got a Datsun B210. I'm still driving.
the cars are beautiful. I just can't picture it being. You know, they're putting a lot of money into these technologies. And yes, it might come around sooner or later, but it's not going to be anytime soon. It was a little disappointing.
So let's just get back to 5G for a second, because that has been bantered around 100 times, 5G, 5G, 5G. And 5G is not just one more than 4G. It's a whole different spectrum, right?
Yes. I mean, you're looking, and it's being upgraded pretty quickly, right? I mean, if you look at it, which... Yeah, from 3G, and you're looking, even undeveloped nations or you know, emerging markets still have 3G. They haven't even upgraded to 4G yet. So, you know, we're going to have 5G. The China's is probably a little bit ahead of us in 5G, but it is coming out. There's going to be, yeah, the best players, I think, when it comes to 5G. I mean, you know, I wouldn't buy the AT&T's or, I mean, I do like AT&T here, but I wouldn't buy, you know, the Verizon's or even the tower companies.
You wouldn't buy like AMT? You wouldn't buy like that?
No, I mean, look, you could buy them, and I'd have to, you know, it's on an individual basis to see where the stock is, and you know, I haven't analyzed these companies. But the big beneficiaries are going to be Intel and Qualcomm. I mean, they were involved in this trend 3 years ago. They're all in. They're the ones that are supplying a lot of this technology. And we'll see how much it is as a percentage of their overall revenue, because it's not really pure play 5G companies, right? So many of these big companies are into so many different trends.
Right.
But those are the two biggest.
These are the assisting companies. These are the chip companies that will assist in the bringing 5G to the devices.
To all of devices, to everything. Yes, absolutely.
Yep. So let's talk about some other cool things that you saw there, because I know you talked about some of this, you know, again, these robots, a lot of robots, a window cleaning robot, a ping pong robot. There was some cool gaming. I know there was some hockey that was done there where you can play against that tennis. That looked pretty cool. What's with this Jarvis motorcycle helmet?
Yeah, with the Jarvis, I mean, that's Jarvis, right, from Iron Man. So when you're looking at Iron Man and he puts that helmet on, if you watch the movies, Avengers, you know, he has everything displayed on the screen for him. And it's all voice activated. It's AI capability. You know, it's pretty cool stuff. So
does it have that English sounding gent?
I don't know. But
that'd be good.
If you bought... Probably like, you know, new car, I think in the last 6-9 months, a lot of them have technology where they display the digital outside of the car. So it's like pointing outside the window, and it's like it's pretty cool, actually. So a lot of cars have that now. But that's a technology that they're bringing where you don't have to take your eyes off the road and everything's in front of you and it's not a distraction. And, you know, it'll show you like the directions and stuff like that. And
the problem with that is there's a lot of states that don't, like Florida, where you and I both live, you don't have a helmet requirement. People, which is that's a whole different dumb. That's a whole different level of stupid.
I know. There's people that ride down without helmets. I don't know.
I guess they're figuring that if they go down, they're going to be really badly injured. Might as well just end it all, just all at once. But
yeah,
this is kind of like there was a time when there was a, you know, big discussion about, you know, heads up display, HUD display, where, you know, you have in your car different areas and you see this in certain planes and airplanes and all that. But now they're bringing that whole... I guess the wireless connection potentially between a smart motorcycle that has to obviously output this. Like my boat, we have fly-by-wire and we have other mechanisms that actually talk to each other. So my depth finder, for example, when I'm out there, actually I could pull up all my engine information, you know, so I could see what's going on there, or I can change off to, for example, my GPS unit is connected somehow to my VHF. In the event that something happens, as a button, it will send a signal out and then it will give my GPS coordinates for the distress signal.
That's cool. You see, I like doing these interviews with you because then I learn how, you know, the top 1% lives, you know?
Yeah, of course, naturally, on my 600-foot, you know. So we got that. Also, you know, there was a lot of things like 8K TVs. Are you telling me there was that much of an amazing clarity in the television brightness and all from a 4K?
Oh, it was insane.
Really?
It was absolutely insane.
Were you like, now, it was like three-dimensional or something?
Oh, it was just the quality. I mean, you can see the pores now, not just the sweat off of people in the audience. It was, but then we don't even have 4K content now, right? It's all about content.
Well, Netflix has some, yeah, but generally what you're looking at when you go into Best Buy or when you go to CES is you're seeing their very highly produced, very high quality demos.
Right? Exactly.
So it's a little bit misleading.
And the fact, I mean, you have DirecTV that has some 4K, but most of it's not, you know, it's still not a lot out, and you have converters and stuff like that, but I don't really see, you know, 8K. I mean, it was amazing when you see it, but they're showing content that is in 8K, which, you know, you don't have movies or anything in 8K obviously yet, but this is like the next generation. It wasn't too much of a focus on flat screen TVs this year, even though there was great ones. There was ones that actually, it folded up like a poster. I was amazed.
Did you stick it in your pocket and then go to somebody's house?
No. It's a big screen TV that's in this big thing, and it's like a square thing that you put on, a rectangle thing, and then when you're done, you press a button, and it goes down and it scrolls in, and it comes back up, and it looks like a flat screen regular TV. We also saw cell phones that bend, you know, from Royale was the name of the company, so you know you don't have to worry about fixing your screens pretty soon, but. Yeah, you know, just a technology. It was energy cell technology that was all you had to do is for hearing aids, and it was a big hearing aid company. Windex maybe was the name of it, and
not Hearex.
No. This is like so. It's like the third largest producer of hearing aids, but they have a charger.
What?
Yeah, no. They have a charger through this energy cell technology that it works for 24 hours, and you charge it for 20 seconds.
That's cool. That's cool. Because
that was really
that could be expanded to other areas that, you know, you have devices that need, you know, small devices that need
some phones too. Yeah, I mean, that's the biggest complaint from you think who cares if the phone's a little bit bigger, make it a little bit bigger. Obviously, we liked it, right? It being bigger, they were smaller and they, you know, got in between iPads and phones. But that's the biggest complaint for everybody is charging your phone all the time. You think they would come up with something, you know, I was just surprised. But anyway, you know, one last point here, which I really liked, if you're looking at smart homes, you know, this is a trend that's been around for 4 years. Last year, I became very bullish on it for one reason, that you had a hub as a hub for Alexa where they could basically, you know, link everything up through Alexa. They had Google Home and they had, what is it, the Apple, whatever it's called. This year, that was different is everybody was promoting Alexa and Amazon. It wasn't even Apple. It wasn't Google.
Let me translate that. You're saying that all of the various smart home companies were now integrating primarily and focusing on Alexa. That's what you're saying.
Yes. So basically, and this is what I like the most. Honeywell just killed it in smart homes. They killed it. So they work with 100 different companies. Why is that important? Because most people do one room first. And everything you buy going forward, every appliance is going to be smart. All lights are going to be smart going forward. So yeah, this trend's going to happen whether you like it or not, just like, you know, high definition TV. And, you know, it just happens. Every TV is going to be like that and everything's going to convert. Now, they do one room first and say, the technology is OK, mm-hmm. but I really like something from another company. It's all compatible with Alexa. And that's why you're seeing this trend really. And it's still really in its infancy. I mean, when you really look at the numbers.
Because I have, for example, I have a smart garage door opener. I have a smart lights that around the outside of the house. I have a smart thermostat, but generally speaking, each one has their own app versus using, you know, Alexa, open the garage, Alexa, turn on the lights, yeah. Alexa, turn the oven on or something like that, you know,
which is frustrating. You got to use different app, but this is what Alexa, it'll say download through the Alexa app and it'll be compatible with that system. Just like it's compatible with something like Pandora or different things with your Alexa. And now you have everything off of your Alexa app. And that's why, I mean, Amazon, I think, was by far the biggest one. Everything was Amazon Alexa. And Amazon didn't even have their own display there, right?
Amazon didn't have anything there?
You don't see Apple there. You don't see, you know, Microsoft was there a couple of times. You know, Bill Gates used to speak. But this is like a plow. It's great because it's almost like self-promotion for these guys. Everyone's promoting these companies, right? And making products
Which is smart. It's like Google, you know, you know, all your TVs or a lot of TVs are running on Android. You know, it's Google in the background, which is just fine with them.
By the way, Google did have the biggest presence I've seen there since in 7 years. I mean, they took out a whole entire building. They had probably had like 1,000 people. They dressed up in like, you know, the white like paint suits with dots on them, like Google saying, you know, but it's all for Google Home. But a lot of these companies that I saw, it was Alexa only. They didn't even say, hey, we're compatible with Alexa and Google, which was last year. Everything's Alexa, which surprised me, but it's just, you know, they're light years ahead. I mean, so one of the FAANG companies is actually, you know, continues to innovate.
So you gave me a list of winners and losers, and you thought from your perspective, what you saw, you didn't see all the companies because there are 4,000 companies. There is no way you saw all the companies, but for what you did see, you saw your winners. You saw Amazon as the biggest winner, which we just talked about. Honeywell, which again, another one. IBM. Now, IBM just bought Red Hat, by the way. And, you know, they're trying to bring on growth because they have no internal growth. What was so exciting about IBM?
Because over the past 4 years, I feel like this is Intel. Like, I used to always go to show and be totally disappointed with Intel because they miss mobile, they miss all these trends. And like 3 years ago, they killed it for the first time. And that's the one booth when you go into the main area. That's the biggest booth. They're the first one you see. And like 3 years ago, I was kind of like saying, all right, finally, Intel is getting it. And you know, it was cheap and the stock more than doubled from then. And IBM has been doing that slowly. And now it's, I think, 30, 40% is coming from like their growth initiatives where, you know, they really go in all into AI. And this isn't just me talking because this is a company that I have recommended. And it's, you know, we're doing pretty good on. But when you're looking at where they are right now in terms of going into big data analytics and AI and the major trends, this is the first time I've seen that. You know, they have these statistics displayed in a lot of different places of who's tweeting the companies the most, what's going on. IBM was on all those lists, like by the hour, by the day. Everyone was very impressed. I've never seen IBM on that list ever. And they had, you know, a really good presentation. The guys knew what they were talking about. And it was exciting. People were, like, blown away. And it's nice to listen. They still, you know, are getting into these growth markets. You know, it's still, you know, servers and things like that. But you're seeing that transition. And I love, love, love that acquisition of Red Hat. They've been working with Red Hat for a very long time. It's going to be very big, where they're going to be one of the biggest hybrid cloud providers, private and also public, which is now you're competing with, you know, who owns those markets, where it's Amazon and you have Microsoft. And look what those stocks did because of cloud. These guys are figuring out how to become the best player in hybrid, because some people want it. Their cloud offline, some people want it online, but there's so many different things to merge these things, and you need that open source. And if this thing works, I mean, you're looking at IBM just has like, you know, a little bit over $100 billion market cap, where we saw, you know, $1 trillion market cap. Yes, Apple's come down and you know, Amazon tested that level. I mean, this is a company that could easily double its share price, and it pays a good dividend. It's perfectly safe. I like IBM. I like what they're doing in growth. I love the fact that everybody talks bad about IBM. We talked about the sentiment thing early.
Right,
and
yeah.
Yeah, I just think it's a good, really good name. It, you know, they're making progress, and people really liked it at the conference.
So the other one where you had on here was a bit of a. I was wondering about this. You said Procter & Gamble, P&G. Do they have like what, smart Q-tips or something?
You know what? I love Procter & Gamble because, look, you have a consumer staple, right, which is the most boring business in the world, and now you don't really have pricing power. They have something called P&G Ventures and P&G Labs, and they had like so many different displays, the first time I've ever seen it. And I love this. It's not going to be a big part of their revenue, but I think they're listening to the customers. They're focusing more on millennials. They're creating your own personalized razors through 3D printing, and you can do it right online, and you know, they'll design a fee. They'll send it for you in 3 days. You pick which razor you want, and then they do the monthly thing like Dollar Shave Club, which disrupted the whole industry.
Right.
But it was just cool. And then they had the new skincare products that are over the counter to treat, you know, chronic skin diseases like psoriasis. And it was just really cool. And other things to treat women for menopause.
But can they cure our ugliness?
I think that's the big question, man. I think, yeah, especially for me, hopefully. But you know, it's nice to see, like, that's what I mean when I say Intel and IBM. Like, I love companies that, listen, you got it wrong, I get it, but you're big enough to make that transition. And I just love that Procter & Gamble was there. And it's nice to see that, hey, you're creating some cool products, some fun products. Maybe some work, maybe don't. But all you need to do is add a very small growth component to these slow growers. And then what happens? Your multiple increases, right? You start trading a little bit more like a growth stock. So look, it's not going to happen right away. Don't run out and buy Procter & Gamble. But it's just nice that that's the only really consumer staple company I saw. And maybe 2-3 years from now, you're going to see them well ahead of the rest of the market.
And the losers, you said, are pretty much what you described before, which is your wearables and some of the, you know, things that are, you know, they get a lot of hype, like iRobot, which, by the way, iRobot makes more than just a vacuum cleaner, right?
Yeah, they receive a lot of the, you know, I was looking it up really quick on the profits they generate. It's a big component of their profits, I believe.
And no, it's a very big profit. Was it the Roomba or something like that?
Yeah, the Roomba, yep.
But, you know, this again, it's where's the limitation of that? You start getting into other possible robotics that could do multitasking, which I'm not sure what that is. Maybe back to your, maybe the window washing company is going to come out with a vacuum cleaner, you know?
That was amazing. That's what they did. It's called Ecovacs. And so they have like a almost, you know, Roomba, but it's a square and it hooks up and it washes the window. So now you have something that cleans windows outside where, you know, I grew up in New York City and you're seeing, you know, the window washers of 40, 50, 60 story buildings. I mean, so I thought that was an amazing product. And they had to me, it was better than the rumor one, robotic vacuum cleaner, but they had 12 models that they're going to, 12 different models that they could launch. And that was about the fifth or sixth company I saw. So obviously iRobot hasn't locked up the right patents for this. There's easy barrier, you know, the low barriers to entry. And you look at a company that generates a lot of their revenue off this product. That's the same thing with GoPro. I mean, GoPro, there was a lot more cameras there. I know the Hero 7 came out. They took out a booth. And they had a big booth the past couple of years. But they took out a booth right next to Panasonic, pretty close to Samsung. Samsung spends millions. They had the biggest presence. They went right in the middle this year, spent a fortune. I know that camera is good, but again, I saw probably at least a half a dozen cameras that had reviews.
Doing the same thing.
Better reviews and everything. Right. So I just don't see GoPro.
Listen, they were the first in. They didn't lock it up right. They started going down the theme of, oh, we're going to be we're going to have content and we're going to sell content. And they got really far from where they should be. Let me wrap this up because we're running out of time here. And I do want to have you back on because I want to talk about your security token offering. We don't have much time today to talk about this, but you want to just, first of all, a lot of the ideas that Frank talks about and others and a lot of the things that he discusses is, you know, available in a newsletter, several newsletters. Just rattle off a couple of those newsletters for us.
Yeah, we have Curzio Venture Opportunities, which is our high-priced newsletter where I travel the world and find the best ideas, very small-cap ideas that can become like the next Microsoft, Google. That's why I travel so much. But Curzio Research Advisory is like a mid-large-cap newsletter we charge under $100 for. And, you know, we have other products as well, including a crypto intelligence, which is just going to focus on security tokens going forward. Because this market, it's not like the ICO market. And I know it's hard to distinguish, but the ICOs, you don't get an equity stake in any of these things. I mean, if Microsoft comes in and buys one of these companies for $20 billion, you get nothing. I mean, it's just you're in that token and that gives you the right to use their products and services. And I've analyzed over 500 of these companies out of the 2,000 so far that are trading. And these companies aren't even generating revenue. Some don't even have a website yet. Yeah, the security token market is different, and I'm such a believer in this market that it makes so much sense that I think it's going to be a monster market, and it's going to disrupt so many industries like investment banking. Is you're looking at, you're giving away an equity stake using a token. Why would you do that compared to a traditional capital raise? Is it's open to accredited investors, and your token's going to come out on exchanges that are going to be launched, a security token exchange like Coinbase. You know, you're looking at Overstock as well, with T0 is going to have their platforms, over a dozen platforms. These are going to be regulated. They're going to trade just like, you know, stocks. They're going to trade very, very similar. You're going to have voting rights and things like that. So this is the way it should have been. When you're buying these, you're getting an equity stake. These are going to pay dividends. You don't have to report earnings every 3 months compared to the amount of fees that you have to pay if you do the traditional route. And if you do, you know, simple private placements, you lock up your money for a very, very long time because your liquidity event is going to be what? Either your IPO or you get acquired. But really quick, we're doing something very special, launch the Curzio Equity Owners Token. But, you know, even if you're interested, you can email me, frankcurzioresearch.com. If not,
Back up. You slid right through that. Email you at what address?
At frank@curzioresearch.com. And I appreciate that. And you know, even if you're not interested in ours, please do me a favor. Just start researching this industry. The news that's coming out, what this opens the doors, tokenization, is you could tokenize a portion of your assets. There's $200 trillion in real estate assets. That's illiquid. So now you could sell off a portion of it. And we're seeing companies do this. We just saw, you know, one of Andy Warhol's paintings sold to Christie's for over $5 million. They tokenized 30% of it, which gives people like you and me an opportunity to maybe buy into that. Right. And now you have this asset, like, you know, and if it goes higher, you're going to make money off of it. But it opens up the door for illiquid assets where you could own a piece of these. So that's not the traditional market that's going on, which is going to continue to crash. But this market makes a lot of sense. I've been studying this market for 6 months, pretty much 15 hours a day. And I believe in it so much for basing my company and my reputation on it. And, cool. You know, I think it's going to be something very, very big.
Interesting stuff. Frank Curzio from CurzioResearch.com. Because Frank does, you know, by the way, for a lot of people who like to listen to podcasts at 2x or 3x speed, impossible. Frank is like, he's like the Hamilton of podcasting. You know,
I try to get everything in.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing. We did a 3-hour podcast right now in 55 minutes. Pretty impressive.
A lot of information. A lot of stuff. So hopefully everybody enjoyed it.
All right, great. And listen to his great podcast and make sure to get more information. We'll have a link to his information over on the show notes for episode number 596. And I want to tell everybody, thank you so much for joining me. And thank you, as always, for your great emails. You can go over to Ask Andrew on thedisciplinedinvestor.com and simply ask a question, and maybe it'll be on the show or I'll answer you directly. And of course, the old things that we have going on over there. We're just about to put out our quarterly piece. We up on the site, we send out to clients first, just talking about some things about investor sentiment this time and talking about the economic cycles and talking about what's going on with the potential for, you know, drop in growth and a variety of other things. So make sure to check that out over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Otherwise, I'll see you again next week. Thanks for joining me.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.